I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. And this way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome back to another episode of Australian Golf Passport. My name is Scott Warren and I'm joined as always by Matt Mollica. G'day, Matty.
G'day, Scott. Really excited to talk with you today. We've got a cracker of a course for the subject of this episode. It's been great fun to research and I'm sure it's going to be even better fun to chat with you about it.
I was about to say something cryptic before we went to News of the Week without naming the course, but of course it will have been in the title of the episode. And so everyone listening will know that we're about to talk about Ellerston. But before we do, got some News of the Week. Maybe before the News of the Week, or maybe this is part of the News of the Week, is that we're really excited to announce that we are going to be partnering with, sponsored by Angus and Grace Go Golfing. And Angus and Grace Go Golfing is something quite close to my heart because it's very close to the heart of my good friend, Matt Burns. He created Angus and Grace Go Golfing about 2 years ago and branched out into his own line after a career working for tailors and fashion designers. He's a Sydney golfer who really felt that there just wasn't the right type of golf gear that he wanted to wear and that his mates wanted to wear. And so he founded Angus and Grace Go Golfing, which is named after his two dogs, who are both West Highland White Terriers, Angus and Grace. He's opened up a retail space in Sydney, which has got a really great array of golf gear. It's a boutique golf shop with old Persimmon and Blade golf clubs for sale, vintage golf balls. He's got a rack of putters. He's got a whole bunch of great stuff in there. Also carries some equipment and some gear from time to time from other kind of bespoke Australian golf companies, and that changes from time to time, but definitely worth sticking your head in there. Bit of background on Angus and Grace Go Golfing. So we started to offer golf as an alternative to sportswear-based brands by creating golf wear that's easy to wear, both on and off the course, and completely designed and made in Australia from beautiful fabrics. All textiles are natural and eco-friendly. The garments are produced in two Sydney-based manufacturers, 100% Australian made, highest quality, and committed to supporting Australian flora and fauna, with 2% of every sale being donated to WIRES. One of the things I really liked about this when Matt reached out and said, did I think there might be something in a partnership, is that I look at the clothes that Angus and Grace Go Golfing makes, and to me it's very much like a great golf course being built. You know, there's shades of 7 Mile Beach in my mind of, you know, someone with just an absolute passion for the art form and this pathological commitment to quality over all else, building something that's lasting and sustainable and striking, you know, that really stands out. So I think there's some parallels to what we talk about on this podcast, Matt, where it's about, you know, pursuing really great things that are lasting and sustainable, and for the clothing Matt makes, just, you know, really beautiful.
Absolutely. It appeals to me that it's designed and made in Australia and that there's a great design ethos behind every piece. Really considered colours, fabrics. I just love the fact that everything he makes is so versatile. I could wear it out one afternoon, one evening if I was going for drinks. I can go out after golf having worn that stuff and not look like I've walked straight off the course. It's not overly techie. It's not trashy sort of fast fashion. I just love what they do.
One of the other things I love about it, and I actually got stuck into this topic in an early episode and Matt had to cut it out because I got so fired up that it was sort of, you know, a bit ranty. We decided to drop it. But logos in Australian golf, there are so many very bad logos of Australian golf clubs. I love the logo. Jump online to angusandgracegogolfing.com. Have a look at the logo. It's just this simple orange circle with a kind of same colored outline of the dogs. And I just think it's simple and it's striking. You notice a bit more detail when you look closely at it. Yeah, bad logos in Australian golf are a bugbear of mine. And I love the logo for Angus and Grace Go Golfing.
Yeah, understated, simple. It's good.
So thank you to Matt for that, and thank you to Angus and Grace as well for what say they might have had in it. So we're excited moving forward with Matt with that partnership. But other news of the week, Matt, there's some other things that are happening in golf. One of them is that Commonwealth's reopening tomorrow. Tell us about what's happening there, Matty.
So Commonwealth members have seen much of their course worked on over the last 6 or 7 months. They haven't had the most ideal growing season this summer down here in Melbourne. We haven't had heaps of heat. We haven't had stacks of sun to allow couch growth, but the course is in a state where all of that work over the previous half year is ready to go. So the 10th hole is playing as two shorter holes. Members finish on 17, and I think they're keeping 18 for a short time as a practice facility and warm-up range and teaching facility until such time as the range is set for use. So light at the end of the tunnel after some short-term pain for the guys at Como. I'm sure that we'll get some word back on how that work has fared and how the course changes look. Really excited to hear about that. There's also a little bit of work happening down on the Gutter course at the National. We have Tom Doak and Brian Schneider and Clyde Johnson coming down to address the safety issue that the club's identified in past times involving 17 and 18. So 17, for those who haven't played Gunner Matter, is a drivable par 4. You hoik your drive off that tee and you hit pretty close to the 18th tee, which is unsighted to you from the 17th tee. So going to need to be a couple of little minor changes made there. No doubt those guys will do that well.
Yeah, it was sort of the one kind of blight, I guess, on an incredible redesign. And I'm really curious how they achieve that without losing 17, you know, by and large, as it is. Maybe it's a movement of the tee or maybe it's something else, but be a shame if they had to lose the 17th hole as we know it to solve that problem, because, you know, it's probably one of the three best holes on the course.
Yeah, if that tee moves back 40 metres and the 18th is suddenly unreachable for guys with driver in their hands, it's safe, but you lose a lot in doing that. Mm. And I've heard a lot of members say that they really don't want the 17th to change very much because they love it so much. So
yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Now up in Sydney, Bonnie Doon is hosting the TPS series event in Sydney this week. Went out this afternoon to see Mike Clayton, have a bit of a walk around, see the course. Clates is out there with Suo and Elvis Smiley, who are sort of his two charges that he caddies for and keeps a close eye on when they're playing locally. Firstly, just really demeaning to my golf game to watch those two play 5 or 6 holes, because professional golfers are so good. I mean, you know they're good, but then when you watch them hit it live, it's like, you know,
there's orders of magnitude between what they do and what we do.
Indeed. But the thing that I was really pumped to see is the golf course looking as good as I've seen it in probably 5 or 6 years. Some width has been rediscovered where it had disappeared a little bit. Despite a really wet week in Sydney, it was quite firm underfoot. We've got wind and heat forecast between now and the weekend, so hopefully that'll amp up a little bit more. The roughs, which in the past, one of the things I haven't really got is the club pursuing these really thick, long roughs. Roughs have been burnt out with a chemical so that the couch rough is thinner and shorter. The sort of couch rough that you can back yourself to go for the green from and maybe get a flyer. So it's the more interesting way, I think, for couch rough to be presented. Looks really great. The new 12th green has bedded in really nicely. I think, if anything, it's probably an improvement, a slight improvement on what was originally built back in 2012. So really excited for the club. They've had some shocking weather in the past when this tournament's been held. So I'm hoping this forecast holds out and we get warm, dry, a little bit breezy. Look at 6,000 metres, so someone's going to go low. But, you know, I think it'd be great for the club to see that be a good tournament under good weather. And then so the other little tidbit in Sydney is that this time next week, Mackenzie and Ebert will be at New South Wales Golf Club for the first time to chat to members about their view for the redesign of the golf course. So, update renovation, new bunkering, you know, rebuild of greens. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited and pretty interested to see what it is that they have in mind. I'll be curious to see how similar their plan is to the one that Tom Doak and Brian Schneider developed back in about 2019, closer to that work being done and hopefully realizing the potential of that golf course too.
Yeah, that's exciting. All right, our main course, let's get into it. We are really, really excited to talk about this course. We didn't schedule an episode on Ellerston when we were mapping out 2023. We had it in comments from one or two listeners, questions from one or two people asking if we would devote an episode to it. And yeah, the more we thought about it, the more appealing it became. So here we go.
Look, kind of just fell out of me when we were talking about, was it last week with Bonnie Doone? And I mentioned playing, I talked about when we played Ellerston and Bob Harrison was there driving around in a cart and we could ask questions. It helped you understand the architecture. And it was after that I kind of thought, oh, we should probably do an episode on that. And secondly, I thought if we just name drop it and then just never talk about the course, that's probably a bit of a wanky, unfair thing to do. So, yeah, it was like, of course we should. We asked for the right approvals to talk about what we saw and what we did up there a long time ago, and we got them. So here we are.
Yeah. So you and I, to fill the audience in, you and I were part of a larger group that traveled there for an overnight stay and two rounds on the course. And we ended up playing three or four courses on a multi-day golf trip.
Yeah, October 2013 it was.
Yeah.
And we'll get to this, but I can remember 17 of the 18 holes like I played them yesterday, which is uncommon 10 years down the track.
Yeah. I've always put some stock in that ability to remember holes, and I think I just naturally do it, and I'll remember the shots that my playing partners have hit or the scores that they've had on particular holes. And occasionally guys will sort of look at your post round while you're having a beer and how do you remember that? Or you'll ask them for their idea on a favorite hole and they look at you blankly. All the people that we've all spoken to that are in the lead up to this episode, they seem to remember a lot of specifics from that very, very clearly. Jeff Shackelford's publishing a book later this year talking about golf course design, golf architecture for normal people. And one of the measurement tools that he uses in this book is hole-by-hole memorability.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of those more demanding holes and those challenging tee shots, I'll think about the seventh and the eighth and a couple of other holes, and like you'll get this little butt pucker thinking about the hole a decade later, and it's the memory of those is crystal clear,
mm-hmm.
which says something about that course.
Yeah.
So
why don't you for listeners who might be from overseas, they might be younger and not necessarily know how the Packers became the Packers. Who was Kerry Packer and how did he come to have Greg Norman built this golf course for him?
So Kerry Packer enjoys legendary status in Australian society. He was a famous media mogul. He served for decades as the head of an empire that controlled newspapers, magazines, television stations, and casinos. And he passed away in his late 60s on Boxing Day 2005.
Was he only in his 60s?
Yeah, 68.
Wow.
A lot of kidney problems.
Mm-hmm.
Prodigious smoker, prodigious gambler. You may remember that he was the recipient of a kidney donation from his long-serving helicopter pilot, Ross.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was not well for a long while. And at the time of his passing, Kerry was widely regarded as Australia's wealthiest man. And his net worth was estimated in excess of $6.5 billion at that time.
And that's, what, almost 20 years ago?
Yeah.
So $6.5 billion 20 years ago was... Yeah, that was some cash. Money.
So Kerry loved sport. He loved golf. He loved polo. Outside of Australia, he's probably most widely recognised for being the founder of World Series cricket. The property at Ellerston has some of the world's finest polo fields there, and it's the home of many of the world's finest polo horses. Kerry's dad, Frank, was pretty sporty. He was a golfer, and he sort of blazed the trail for Kerry. Did his own prodigious amount of work in the media industry. He first bought some land at Ellerston near the Barrington Tops National Park, and Kerry later acquired more land to increase the size of the station. Kerry, we said, loved golf. He was a member at Royal Sydney and a member at the Australian later in his life. He's on the honour boards at both clubs. He was really a driving force in the Australian being a multi-year home for the Australian Open from 75 to 78. He was the main sponsor of the Australian Open at that time. He was responsible for Jack Nicklaus redesigning the course at Kensington. And reading some background articles, there wasn't much by way of appearance fees paid to a lot of the visiting American pros, but they stayed at Kerry's house in Bellevue. And I think they would have had a great time while they were there.
Yeah.
And
Kerry's also the reason that the Aussie doesn't have corporate days, because he turned up on a Tuesday one time when he just joined with, you know, three mates, and they said, oh, Mr. Packer, you can't play today. We've got a corporate day. And he said, what do you mean I can't play? I'm a member. And they said, yeah, well, this day of the week's for corporates, and we've got a group out on the course and you can't play. And he said to them, well, how much do you get a year from the corporates? And they said what the figure was. And he wrote a check for 10 times that much, said, that's a decade's worth. I don't want to see them out here ever again. And to the best of my knowledge, they still don't have corporate days.
No.
Regularly, at least.
Those sorts of stories are legendary about Kerry. Everyone will have one or two that they have at the forefront of their mind. But the more you research him, the more you hear about these amazing stories involving gambling and generosity oftentimes to people around him.
Well, so after he had a heart attack and he was saved, he gave he basically paid to have defibrillators put in every ambulance in New South Wales, and they became known belovedly in Sydney as Packer Whackers.
Yeah, they're still known. They're still known by that name, apparently.
Yeah.
So he was very lucky in that a Mica fitted ambulance was close to him when he had that scare in 1990. And had there not been a defib unit near him, he might have died more than a decade before he eventually did. Kerry's a larger than life figure. He, as we said, extended the size of Ellerston to in excess of 30,000 hectares. So Ellerston is a pastoral station that sits in the upper Hunter Valley past Scone. It's a working station. There's more than 200 people that live there. It's home to cattle, merino sheep, polo horses. Kerry's buried there near the polo fields. The golf course has been there for more than 20 years now. Ellerston, as we said, is a four-hour drive from the Sydney Harbour Bridge. You pass Arrowfield Stud when you get there. And you also pass the Moon and Flat Pub, Scott.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Home of your legendary pineapple cruiser. Just magnificent. The thing I noticed, you mentioned those studs as you get up close to Ellerston. The thing that struck me was just millions of dollars worth of post and rail fencing on all of those paddocks. And there's racehorses there, you know, that's where a lot of the kind of triumphant horses go to stud. And there is so much money in the Upper Hunter Valley. It's wild.
I remember driving along at 90 clicks and continually looking out at this immaculate fence and thinking, what on earth is behind there? Not obviously not realizing it was Reduce Choice and stacks of other horses. So
yeah, it's quite a place. But then, the Moon and Flat Pub is the Australian country pub out of Central Casting. It's not pretentious at all. You know, there's a little bar that's probably, you know, 3 meters long, couple of fridges. Everyone sits out in the beer garden, which is actually just a garden with some tables around.
Yeah.
And it is an odd gateway to such a incredibly exclusive place, because it is, you know, just the kind of place that you'd pull up in any country town and have a schooner.
Well, I remember my phone charge was running low and I had a cable with me and I was flat out finding a PowerPoint in that pub. And then at 7:30, when the sun had set and dinner was being served, it sprung to life. There were dozens and dozens of people there, and you look around and wonder where on earth they came from. And
I remember
it was a beautiful dinner as well. So yeah, it's about 20 clicks on a winding road from that pub to the front gate at Ellerston. And obviously for us, that was a final 20K that was filled with a reasonable amount of excitement.
Yeah.
We talked about the course being there for more than 20 years, and it's a Greg Norman design, and Bob Harrison was the man on the ground for an awful lot of time while Ellerston was designed and being constructed. I've got a little quote here from Greg Norman that, if you'll allow me to read it. "For me, Elliston was a very special project. It had taken me more than 10 years to convince my good friend and passionate golfer, Kerry Packer, that he should build his own golf course. And when the decision was finally made, he ensured the brief was unique. Create the best golf course possible with as few tees as possible. In other words, build a golf course that penalizes poor shots and makes the golfer think and play hard. He got all that plus more. The land at our disposal was ideal, and the natural features, as well as the flora and fauna, was so spectacular that very few routings were actually done, as the holes virtually mapped themselves. We had no need to consider forward tees, resort traffic, or weaker hitters, and could make the carries demanding and the holes as formidable as required. The whole process proved particularly enjoyable, as we were able to create a course that a golfer of my caliber would love to play every day for the rest of his life. Even more pleasing was being able to tour the property shortly after construction with a delighted owner as he surveyed his finished course for the first time. From the outset, we knew the potential was enormous, but I am nevertheless ecstatic with the result, as Elliston is clearly one of the best golf courses in Australia." So that was Greg Norman's summation of things around the time of construction. One little snippet that I forgot to mention was that Greg and Kerry were good friends. They had paired together to take out the Pebble Beach Pro-Am almost a decade prior to Elliston being opened. And they won in a landslide back in 1992. They won with a combined score of 42 under, and they were six shots ahead of second place. So no doubt a special project for Greg Norman, and an extremely special project for Bob Harrison as well, with a huge amount of contact with Kerry during that time. He was on site, as you mentioned at the outset of the episode, while we had our visit to Elliston, which ramped things up another notch for us, if that was at all possible. It was really exciting to hear him talk about the particular holes as you travel around them and why things were the way they were.
Yeah, I think it was interesting from some of the things that Bob said on that day, and then slightly at odds with what Greg said in that passage you just read out. I think Greg does them a disservice by saying the land at our disposal was ideal. I think in reality, I mean, it's quite heavy soil and it's quite a steep site. I think the fact that they were engaged by Australia's richest man to build a golf course that most weeks and months he'd be the only person that played allowed them to do some things that you wouldn't otherwise do, and I think made that more workable than if you were building a golf course on that property for a club that was going to have 800 members and every Saturday and Sunday there'd be 200 players. I think you would have ended up with a lesser golf course and a much less memorable golf course. So I think that's probably, yeah, every architect likes to say when they're finished that, you know, this the best site for golf I've ever seen. I actually think what was built, you know, belies how unfavorable, you know, maybe a little bit like Cathedral down in Victoria recently, how unfavorable the soil and the terrain really are for golf in that kind of place.
Yeah, if I gave you the state of New South Wales to design your dream golf course in an unlimited budget, you're not heading to the banks of Pages Creek, are you?
No.
You're looking at something flatter and something sandy, and they did really well. I think they had 30,000 hectares to look over. I remember Bob saying that they basically had carte blanche to search the site for wherever they wanted to put the course, and it made a lot of sense to put it where they did. Pages Creek winds through that area, and that's used repeatedly throughout the round to provide a lot of interest on tee shots, really daunting and intimidating looking approaches, and it adds some beauty to the landscape as well. You get quite close to the creek repeatedly on the front nine and back nine.
Mm. I think creeks are a really great way to have water on a golf hole and not make it gratuitous or penal or frustrating. I think creeks lend themselves really nicely to strategic design and to, you know, a light touch, the water having a light touch rather than the water dominating the hole, you know, like say the 18th at the Australian, 18th at Sawgrass, etc. The thing I think that Elliston did really have going for it that I, when I reflect on our visit there, that I always go to was it's sort of in this you know, not an immediate amphitheater, but this regional amphitheater almost, that there's these mountain ranges that encircle the valley that you're in. You know, there's hills in the foreground, then there's bigger mountains off in the distance, and you're almost dwarfed, despite how big and steep that property is, you're dwarfed by the landscape around you. And it's notable that when you kind of stand in most parts of the course and swivel around on those must be millions of hectares that you can see climbing away from you, you can't see a single building. You're very much just in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
I had someone tell me that it would be a great place to take a multi hike. The scenery looks fantastic. And I can definitely see what they mean by that.
I mean, if you were going to dispose of a body, it would be ideal. And I'm not referencing Kerry being buried near the course either. But no, it is legitimately middle of nowhere. And as you said, your mobile phone reception slips away long before you're at the front gate.
Yeah. So that sense of isolation really enhances the whole experience and the time on the course too. You're away from overhead wires and the hustle and bustle of suburbia and any sort of built environment, which is really attractive. You look in the distance beyond a lot of greens. And as you said, there's mountain ranges and beautiful vistas everywhere you turn.
Yeah, that's to me, that's one of the things that I think, coupled with some of the holes that they built, and I love that they kind of broke the mold on, well, we don't need to get a field of 200 through this on a Saturday, so let's build something that's a bit unconventional and daring. And yeah, that might have worked most of the time. There might be some examples of holes that didn't quite land, but I love the fact that they went and you know, famously, Kerry's advice to Greg Norman was, build me the hardest golf course you can. I think you could have built the hardest golf course you can in a much less characterful way. I like that it's, you know, there are some shots that, albeit I might think, oh, that doesn't really work, but I've never seen it before that day and I've never seen it since. So that's pretty cool in its own right. And you commend Greg Norman and Bob Harrison for having the courage, you know, to do it, because Kerry Packer was also not somebody who suffered fools or put up with things that weren't to his liking. You know, for every famous story about his reckless gambling or his generosity to charity, there's a story about him, you know, tearing an employee, you know, ass from breakfast hole for something that probably wasn't that bad. So, these guys backed themselves, and that's pretty impressive.
In the lead up to the episode, I went back and had a look at about an 8 or 9 minute snippet of his appearance before a Senate committee into media ownership. And if any of you are unfamiliar with Kerry Packer and you want to get a bit more of an understanding of him, I would go onto YouTube and I'd have a look for that Senate inquiry. And remember that he's talking to publicly elected federal senators. Mm-hmm. And it really is something. So I wouldn't want to do the wrong thing around him, and I wouldn't want to make him angry. And I can't imagine the nervousness that you would harbour building a golf course for him with his money on his land. Kudos to Bob and to Greg in doing such a good job. To echo your points that you've made in the last couple of minutes, Scott, I also came across one little comment from Darius Oliver, who had written Planet Golf and Australia's Finest Golf Courses, the latter of which was published just as Ellerston opened. And one of the things that he says in relation to the course, you could not possibly build a course like Ellerston for public consumption. For a start, 90% of golfers would be unable to handle it, and those who could would no doubt be frustrated by the 5 hour plus rounds as the average guy searches for ball after ball. As I state again and again, those capable of hitting the shots at Ellerston demands, so good ball striking, single figure markers and professionals, they'll find Ellerston an incredible experience and about as much fun as one can have on a devilishly difficult golf course.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good summation.
I think so. And I mean, to his point, we played 36 there. You and I at that point were sort of seven markers, were with a plus one and a one. And everyone found it pretty taxing.
Yeah. Yeah. You needed to smoke tee shot after tee shot. And even as I think back in my mind's eye now of the approach to the third, the approach to the fifth, lots of shots. I just think, man, this needs to be our golf shot. You need to be accurate. Yeah, it was testing. And so we sort of made a vow when we first started the podcast, Scott, that we weren't going to go on hole by hole by hole ad nauseum and talk about things that a lot of people hadn't seen. And as luck would have it, there is a 9-minute drone flyover of all 18 on Elliston that sits on the internet to this day and has been there for years. I'll put a link to that in our show notes. So for guys and girls who want to get a really good look at Elliston, that is the way to do it. It gives a really good view of the elevated tee shot on the par 5 first, right through to the approach into 18. And that'll complement what we talk about in the next little while as far as difficult holes, thrilling approaches, the standout holes that we recall from that layout.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd encourage you to look for that before it's scrubbed.
Yeah. So. And I think what that will show that an aerial wouldn't is that there's actually quite a good aerial if you just go on Google Maps and type in Elliston Station. There's a pretty good aerial of the course and a kind of Formula One quality go-kart track in the middle of it. What the aerial doesn't show you is must be, what, 150 metres of climb from, say, the 7th tee to the 10th green.
Yeah.
You know, it's a steep, in parts, very steep bit of land, and the aerial doesn't give that away at all. So, yeah, that drone fly-through is, I don't know who got it or how, but it's sensational.
Yeah, and it climbs again after that from memory. You hit up to the par 3 12th green.
You come back down the hill from 11, and then 12 is, yeah, that long par 3 up the hill, about 170 metres.
And that par 3 12th tee, not to indulge ourselves too much, but
I know exactly what you're about to say.
That was the site of one of the greatest first world problems that I've ever heard in my life. you had a pitch repair tool that you had acquired while you were playing golf, while you were living in London, and you'd taken it to the course that day and lost it at some point prior. Thought you had lost it at some point prior?
No, I'd actually just got it. I'd been over on a trip to Europe just about 2 months before this, and I'd got to play at Morfontaine in Paris. So yeah.
I remember you frisking yourself and patting your pockets and then looking at me a little bit
nervously. In a sweating panic, yeah.
And said, I've lost my Morfontaine pitch tool while playing Elliston.
Why does nothing good ever happen to me? I
said. Yeah, that was dreadful.
Yeah, that was. But I found it in my back pocket a hole later. I don't know why I put it in my back pocket, but... yeah, I've still got that. It's good. It's lucky.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, yeah.
That was great.
No, look, we are incredibly fortunate to have seen the place. Not many people do. And, you know,
it seems to get about 500 rounds a year.
There you go. So, yeah, and you'd imagine that potentially a couple of hundred of those might be by 10 people. Notwithstanding that, though, Matty, we did, when we started this podcast, kind of swear a blood oath to each other that we wouldn't just blow smoke insincerely. We'd call out the stuff that we thought was really good. We'd call out the things that we maybe didn't love. And I don't want us to do any different for this episode because, you know, the Packers might be listening and we might not ever get invited back. Let's dive into the character of the course, the difficulty, how we sort of found playing the golf course. What would your sort of summary, you know, say you're playing golf on the weekend and you mark your ball on the green and someone recognises the Elliston logo that you might have on a ball marker and says, oh, you played Elliston. What's it like? What's your initial 30-second response to that question?
I think I talk about the experience first and foremost, like the whole 24 hours of going there, even the thrill of just realising that I was going to play there. I don't focus on course quality as much as I would if that 30-second discussion was talking about Barnboogle Dunes or Royal Melbourne West or one or two other courses like that. Immaculate conditioning, some standout holes, some really difficult holes, some thrilling and challenging holes. They're the first things that come to mind. You?
Yeah, I think just generally I would reflect on how bold it is and how striking. You know, it really is like a golf course in Kerry Packer's image. You know, bold, striking, unforgettable. It's going to give you a feeling. It's going to give you an opinion that you walk away with. And so, yeah, I think there are holes there. There are shots that are too much for the mere mortal. And I guess you need to then remember that this is a golf course in someone's backyard that one of the greatest golfers of all time was told to make it as hard as he possibly could. A golfer who famously probably drove the ball better than anyone who's ever drawn breath before. And that sort of explains some of the shots, like the seventh tee shot, you know, the eighth. There's a few tee shots where, you know, your life flashes before your eyes as you take the club away. And that's by design and by intention. Yeah, it may not. To me, I think that's probably why it's, let's say maybe it's like in the conversation for the 15th best golf course in the country instead of the fifth best. You know, I think that's such a striking part of its character and its purpose and its personality. But, you know, Darius kind of noted it in his comment. If even a group that we were in that had two sixes, a one and a plus one are really not quite up to the ask a lot of the time, you know, that's a lot of golf course. When you're appraising it the way that you appraise golf courses to rank them for every man, woman and child to play. But, you know, for what it was intended to be, when you look at what Packer's brief was, what they built is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, they met their brief. They did what was asked. One of the knocks that people occasionally put on the course is that it's not walkable. There's multi-hundred meter spans from one tee to, from one green to another tee on several occasions, and there's paths, and all the people on it are going to be in carts, and it's in someone's backyard. So I'm sure Kerry didn't lose any sleep about people's critical opinions about the course in that regard. But when you compile a list of all of the courses in the land and match them up against one another, that's something that you have to consider. So you're not raving in that 30 second thumbnail sketch that you asked about before. You're not I'm not grabbing someone by the lapels and shaking them and saying you've got to see this place before you die. It would be wonderful if they could, but
yeah. And I think, like, to put that in context too, like, we spent last week waxing lyrical about Bonnie Doone and its 30th. You know, we both dearly love Port Fairy and its 25th or so. You know, huge fans of Newcastle and its 20 or 12. Like, top 20 in the country is a bloody good golf course. It's such a good golf course.
Yeah. And you're splitting hairs at some point when you're starting to order them.
And I'm sure that if there were some people who were involved in the course's development or its operation now listening to this and we're saying we think it's probably 15 to 20, they might be like, mate, get these people's names on a list and they're not coming back. Like, that's insulting. And I get that there's probably a view that some people have that this is, you know, as Norman kind of alludes to in his comment that you read earlier, you know, one of the absolute great golf courses of Australia. I'd say it's probably one of the three top golf experiences in Australia. And coupling that with a top 20 golf course is a pretty great achievement on heavy soil farmland that, you know, you could ski down if it snowed. I think that's, for what they had as a canvas, and we've talked in the past about, you know, what's the canvas, because that will, you know, show me the canvas and I'll show you how good the golf course can be. They've got a ton of land, which was in their favour, but the land that they had a ton of wasn't, as you said, the type of land that your Mike Kaisers and co travel the world looking for to build great golf. No, so definitely. I really think what they ended up with, again, coming back to the brief, it is so hard though. Like, I remember on 70, you know, the four of us, and we're all sort of aged between 25 and 45 at that point, all good golfers, all fit, just ripping driver as hard as we could. And I think two of us barely made the fairway. The other two piped it straight down the middle, but into long rough, because we just couldn't get to the short stuff. And yes, there are up tees on some holes. There's not many, but it's, and I think from memory, it's about 7,300 yards from the back. So it's that 6,600 meters. Yeah. That's a long golf course.
It gives you a solid workout. I think one of the things, if I spoke about the design to someone in more detail, is that there's just so many thrilling, daunting approaches.
Mm.
Forced carries that you obviously don't need to consider when you're designing a publicly accessible course for tens of thousands of players per year. But I keep thinking back to the approaches on 3 and 5, 8,
mm.
13, sort of had a cape quality to it.
Yeah, with a big exposed rock wall on the inside of the dog leg.
Yeah.
It was, yeah, magnificent. I mean, yeah. As you say that, it kind of crystallizes to me that about 80% of the brutal difficulty is off the tee. If you took someone around and they hit shots from, you know, maybe not the A1 position, but if you put them in the C position off the tee, maybe a bit out of position and a little bit further back, some really enjoyable shots into really interesting greens, trying to get the ball near the hole or to leave it somewhere that gave you the best next shot. You know, the greens aren't over the top. They're not absurdly bunkered. It's quite heavily bunkered, but it's not to excess. I think really it is off the tee that most of the almost, you know, potentially unplayable stuff is.
Yeah. And so you consider, we were talking about Pages Creek, which is the main creek that winds through the station and the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And it fluctuates in levels. I remember I stepped over it at one point near 6 and near 16. I just took a stride over it and was on the other side. But it can get a lot more water in it to the point where it washes away whole greens.
Well, even where it crosses the first about 50 yards short of the green, it's probably 15 metres wide and reasonably deep.
Yeah. And so the creek, you contend with it repeatedly on drives at 3 and 5 and 6. It sits left of the par 3 green, and anything that's tugged on that, you wave goodbye. 7, you obviously need to traverse it, and then it makes an appearance again later in the round. So you need you need to be really accurate, which is. And you need to be really long, which perhaps is no surprise on a Greg Norman course. That's really valued at the Moona course at the National, and it's something that's going to serve you well everywhere, but particularly at those courses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, 15 and 16 to me are good holes if we were going to single a couple out. But 15 is a hole that to me sums up being able to go out and just build whatever you want. And 16 likewise. 15's people will be familiar with, you know, that hole in Africa where you tee off from about 200 meters above the Africa-shaped green and you try and get it on, then you catch a helicopter down to the green. 15's like a little version of that to me. It's 240 from the back. It must drop about 50 meters, Matt. Yeah. And quite a well-bunkered green. It's a really striking par 3. You know, you're smashing a 3-wood or a driver from up on a cliff top, looking down over this scenery. It's really a hole that, you know, it's people often say, oh, it's not a hole you could build these days, or it's not a hole. That is legitimately not a hole that you could build on many courses. And maybe the only thing more dangerous than that driver from so high up is trying to get your golf cart then down the path to the green, because that's a steep, twisty little road. I remember being nervous on that. And then you walk onto 16 and it's, you know, it's a long par 4, but absolutely not the type of long par 4 you might be picturing in your mind. You know, it's about 420 meters if you take the brave line, but it's essentially a 90-degree dogleg and the creek dogleg's with you. So your second shot is basically down the length of the creek to this green that's kind of creek on three sides of it, sloping away to the water. It really is, you know, it's a hole that a good friend of ours who shared that day with us despises. And it's funnily enough, I was walking around with Clates today at Bonnie Doon and I mentioned we're doing this tonight. We're talking about the course and some holes. He goes, 16's a terrible hole, isn't it? terrible. So well, it's funny you say that because Maddie and I are actually both big fans of it. And I think that's a good example of, you know, people who often have similar tastes in golf. Out of the four of us, two people absolutely despise the hole. And you and I, you know, if I could go back to Elliston and only play four holes, I'd pick 16 as one of the holes I played. Just because I don't think I've seen something like that before and probably won't again.
Yeah, I might too. There's a few. That, it's a long list. Yeah, it might. Okay, it might make it on. Depending on where you are in the fairway, and our mate might say, "Oh, doesn't matter where you are. You can't see the green, no matter what." I feel that you can get some look at the green around this tree that has been left by the designers that sits on the bank of the creek. Have to negotiate that with your approach and. Yeah, we've got mates who don't like it. I sort of feel you can position your tee shot and make it much less of a visual factor on approach.
So that tree, Matty, as you say that, I'm looking at the aerial and doing some measurements. I might have worked out why you and I like it and the other two blokes who are better golfers don't. It's because if you can only drive at 220, that actually puts you in the perfect frame to be short of that tree and have the great view of the green. If you knock it down there 250, that's where you start being blinded by both that and the tree that then also blocks the green. So maybe it's a case of us being poor enough golfers that we're able to make sense of this thing that Greg built. I'm sure Greg, having built it, if you drive it 320, you also have a good view of the green. So
okay, great.
Greg's fine and we're fine. Clayton Rich are out of luck.
Not okay. That might explain it. It touches on an interesting point. There are several holes out there where trees are a significant factor. And 9 and 10 are the first two that jump to mind. And those who have worked their way through the hole-by-hole flyover will no doubt understand what we're talking about.
Shocking.
Tell us what you really feel, Scott. I remember Bob speaking very fondly at lunch between rounds 1 and 2, where we asked him for his favorite holes and holes that he really liked and holes that he thought turned out really well. And 10 was one of the first that he mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to say, I was surprised.
I took great interest in my steak at that point and just kept my face down. Look, 9 had a cool green, but Bob's a big fan of trees in fairways. There's, you know, windmill in a fairway at Moona. There's a tree in the middle of the first fairway at Stonecutters Ridge in Sydney that was the last course I think he did with Norman before they split. Obviously these two, it's clearly something that philosophically Bob really is into and likes the challenge of or the quirk of. It's just not for me.
Yeah. The grand features several of them.
There you go.
That might be a discussion to have with Bob at a future.
Yeah. And I'm open to the argument for it, but it's just not something that works for me. And certainly on back-to-back holes, long par fives that play uphill, we talked about that 150-meter climb over 3 holes, 4 holes, a good deal of it is on those 2 par fives. It's a lot. And it's not fun, is it?
No, it's not. A little tributary of the creek winds through the second shot landing zone on 10, that par five. So there's back-to-back par fives at 9 and 10, and you play an uphill short approach for your third to the 10th green. 10th green's a really cool green, really nice lay of the land green.
Yeah.
And it appeals to me much more than having trees in a driver landing zone or on a direct path to the green. I would much rather have a ground-based hazard and think, can I carry that and make my third shot really short? Or do I try and come unstuck? Do I accept my fate and think, oh, I'm not going to get there. I hit a poor tee shot and I have to be short of that diagonal creek as it meanders through the fairway with my second. My approach is now going to be much longer than I feel comfortable with. I'm much more in favor of that sort of design, but I understand that is a pretty consistent design feature the world over. And there might be impetus for a designer to say, no, I'm going to do something different. And yeah. And as we've said several times now, if you're going to do something different, this is probably the project where you do something different.
Although it is odd that, you know, the course is built on more than 250 acres. And I recall one in the group in one of the rounds hit a wicked block off that tee that ended up in the center of the 11th fairway, which is right next to it, and actually had probably the best angle you could hope for. Now, again, this is a course that maybe four people play every day. You know, it is where you can play choose your own adventure golf and hit it onto adjacent fairways and not have to worry about, you know, hitting it into groups or whatnot. But, you know, I think a hole where the ideal play is not along that hole, you know, you got to ask questions about, well, is that, could you have built something different that functioned a bit better?
I'd love to ask Bob that. His par threes on this course, so 2, 6, 12 and 15.
Yep.
Distinct differences across those four holes. Two's a delightful little short hole, and the creek sort of winds around the left side of that green.
It delicate, does, yeah.
Delicate little approach where you wanted to be accurate. Six, creek is a much more foreboding visual presence. And there was some discussion about that hole with the routing process. Pages Creek swells once every decade by the sounds of things to the point where it could wash that sixth green away.
Yeah.
But they decided to put it there and just rebuild the green if and when it was ever washed away. And I think they've had to do that at least once since. So. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the extent to which Pages Creek floods, I think, is evidenced by behind the sixth green is one of the many very expensive looking bridges that get you around the course. And that is that's a sturdy bridge, and it's high. It doesn't just clear the creek to get you over it. That's clearly been thought of to get, you know, to still be there after Pages Creek floods, because as you noted a few times, the sixth green and bunkering hasn't been there anymore. Yeah, the creek kind of turns 180 degrees around that green. So you can imagine when Pages Creek's really pumping, the short course for that water once it floods is just to go through the green site. That's probably the hole, I think, where the creek is most noticeable and striking on the whole golf course. It plays the biggest role probably in the sixth compared to any other hole.
Yeah, so that green slopes from right to left. It's reasonably heavily bunkered on the right side, so that's a pretty unattractive miss. If you want to squib it and stay away from the water, you've got a downhill bunker shot to a green sloping away from you towards water. So I really like that hole. It demanded precision, beautifully situated, yeah, made maximum use of the creek for visual effect.
And only about 145, 150 metres too. So not, you know, Norman hasn't just gone, oh, let's put a 3-iron in their hands at every turn. That's a, you know, mid-iron, short-iron hole, which is cool.
Yeah, they felt like they got progressively longer through the round. 12 was uphill and a bit longer to a green that was semi-visible from the tee. And you needed more club than you took on the sixth. And then
12 feels to me a bit like a farmland version of 17 at Lost Farm.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good comp. I like that.
You know, it's imposing. Like, you just got to get up there and hit a shot.
Yeah. And then 15 was the biggest of the lot where you either had driver or 3-wood in hand and hope you didn't wildly spray it.
Yeah. I think the first two being under 150, it offsets some of the difficulty of those par fours on the front, gives a bit of punctuation. You know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 are really tough par fours. 2 and 6 kind of give you a bit of a breather with a set shot with a shorter iron. But yeah, on the back, they really stand up, those par threes. And, you know, 13, 14 are a bit more manageable. 13's longer, but plays downhill. 14's really the only short par four on the property. I think it's about 300 metres from the back tee, and you could have a bit of fun there. Be aggressive for one time in the day.
Yeah, you could have a ping at the green, and that bunkering scheme around that green seems to have changed a little bit over time. I'd looked at aerials and saw a photo of it online, and it seems to have changed a little bit with greenside bunkering. I also don't remember the go-kart track being so close to the 14th fairway. I remember that that's where we had to keep our eyes out for it. We look right after we've hit our tee shots and we walk down the 14th and there's literally a Formula One quality go-kart track with a pit lane and garage.
Incredible. Yeah.
Sitting there off to the side. And
they must have some fun there. They must have so much bloody fun on that place. Like where I grew up, my grandparents had a farm up on the Hawkesbury River out of Sydney. And like, you know, it was 30 acres. It wasn't a million hectares like this. My granddad had built this rudimentary golf course with like flower pots for cups and stuff. It was very basic. It's very basic. We had our motorbikes there and we'd water ski and stuff. And it was just like every day was, as a kid, the best day of your life because you'd get up and you'd have a swim and you'd play nine holes of golf with your granddad. Then you'd, you know, ride the motorbikes. And this just is like an absolute, you know, 1% of wealth version of that. They must just have between polo and go-karts and golf and whatever goes on in the homes that they have there. God, they must just love getting out of Sydney up to Ellerston and just taking a deep breath.
Yeah. Oh, it would be the most wonderful escape for them, I'm sure.
I know it's not in vogue at the moment to humanize the wealthiest people on the planet, you know, and try and empathize or imagine their lives. But I just think this place must just be an absolute treat to be able to escape to when you need. And it's where, interestingly, after a few of Shane Warne's biggest scandals broke, Warney and James Packer, close friends, Warney waited out a little bit of that bad times at Ellerston, just playing golf and enjoying life. Yeah, so.
Didn't know that. There you go.
Sorry, I went off in a bit of a tangent there, but I was just sitting here looking at the aerial of the 14th hole and the go-kart track and just thinking, man, that must just be, you know. Will we race go-karts before or after golf today? So, the par threes, probably the strength of the golf course in terms of, you know, the sets of holes. We've touched on the fives that 1 and 17, I think, are more traditional, interesting par fives, notwithstanding that you mentioned, obviously, 10 has that great little lay of the land green that feeds into Pages Creek. The fives probably aren't the star of the show. The fours, for the most part, are just really, really bloody hard. It's the threes that...
Yeah, they probably stand on top of the dais in terms of design, quality and manageability for the people who play it. In that vein, if I think back on the set of fours as a collective, it was probably a really hard fight where I didn't get killed, I survived. Yeah. And I relished the challenge.
Yeah, indeed.
Conditioning is one thing that we've sort of not really addressed directly. Buffalo grass roughs, which I'm not sure that would be done again if they had their time over with the course, both owner and designer.
Mm. I'd love to ask Bob about that. You know, obviously Buffalo famously a shade grass. If there's one thing they're not lacking up there, it's direct sunlight. I'd be curious why that was chosen.
Yeah. It provides a visual contrast, but it's coarse. It's not a great golf grass. It's immaculately conditioned. Like Darius talks in his book about it being the equal, if not superior, to Augusta National during Masters Week, just because of the fanatical attention to detail and the minimal traffic.
Yeah. I think the minimal traffic's the key there, right? Like they can look after that place to within an inch of its life because, you know, and when we played there, 12 of us went around in the morning, we had lunch and every divot was perfectly sanded and seeded and every pitch mark was gone from the greens that afternoon and you wouldn't have guessed that there'd been people on it that morning. So they do have that luxury, I guess, and that, you know, to really look, I mean, and the crew's probably the size of most private clubs in Sydney. When you've got one greenkeeper to each golfer in a day, you're set up pretty well.
Yeah. So there'll be a couple of people who travel the path that we travelled. They'll start off a lot further away. They'll come from the US or they'll come from the UK and have somehow managed to secure a tee time at Ellerston. They should stop in and see Newcastle at the same time. That's a must, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, two completely different courses and propositions to pair. Yeah, certainly if you're driving up from Sydney, and look, a lot of people probably who made some better decisions than us, Maddie, in life might travel up by chopper. But if you're driving up from Sydney, I definitely think if you're going to break the trip up and play golf, absolutely Newcastle rather than one of the Hunter Valley courses. Although Norman and Harrison also have the Vintage, which is in the Hunter Valley near Pocolbin, more on a direct line from Sydney to Elliston. If you were keen to see more of that repertoire, the Vintage is worth seeing. It's comfortably the best course in the Hunter Valley. It's not Newcastle, but it's, you know, I think it's probably top 75 or so in the country, so it's nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah. Some good wines in the Hunter Valley on the way up or back as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lakes Folly up there and a whole host of others that would be worth visiting.
Yeah,
so that rounds out a trip and gives a non-golfing spouse something to do in that neck of the woods as well. Mm-hmm. Some beautiful places for accommodation.
Yeah, Scone is nearby, which is a great little town. They have the Scone Cup is a race day that, if you're into quirky kind of iconic experiences that aren't, you know, it's not the Melbourne Cup, it's not the Golden Slipper, Scone Cup is worth everyone experiencing, whether you're a horse racing fan or not. It's really a far-flung part of the state's day of days, and everyone's out to make sure they have a good one. So Scone's sort of where Elliston draws a lot of its workforce from. There's a little 9-hole course in Scone that I know we chatted to the crew over lunch at Elliston, and a lot of them are members at Scone and play their golf there. Are really fond of it. So, yeah, again, it's not like Elliston at all, but I think they probably, after spending their working week at Elliston, it's probably nice to retire to something pretty low-key and low stress and enjoy playing some golf.
Yeah. I reckon that rounds us out. I was just looking through the list, and I think we've touched on everything that we wanted to talk about.
Now, if we haven't answered the burning question in your head about Elliston, flick us a DM on Instagram or Twitter and ask away. Happy to do some cleanup at the start of the next episode on anything that we might have overlooked. Yeah, want to make sure that we answer the question that's in your mind, because we're really mindful of how fortunate we are that we got the golden ticket to go and see this place. For those who may not get to do it, we really want to kind of answer the question that might be in your mind and give you the honest answer from two blokes who went there and had a look around.
Spot on. Well, it was as much fun as I thought it would be. Thanks, yeah. Scott.
No, it was very good, mate. As always, enjoyed it. And again, thank you so much to Angus and Grace Go Golfing for joining us and being part of the journey of Australian Golf Passport. We're chuffed to have a sponsor on board. It must mean we're doing something right, Matty.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you to Matt. Really appreciate the support. And those of you in Sydney, stick your head in there. You'll be very happy that you did.
Cheers, Matty. Till next time.